Welcome back to the discussion where the last speaker had the misfortune of being the only one between all of us and a coffee. This entire panel has the misfortune of being the only thing between the rest of us and lunch, but we will do our best to complete by 1 o'clock at lunchtime. My name is Bill Banks. I'm a professor and director of a Center on National Security and Counterterrorism at Syracuse University. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank IPI and the SLAPP Foundation and other supporters of this project for including me. I must say that a year ago when I was asked about the perpetual peace and Immanuel Kant, I shuddered briefly. I went down to my cellar in my house and found a copy of Kant with a good inch of dust that hadn't been read since my days in university, I think. But it was like discovering an old friend, and more approachable, I'd say, at my ripe old age than he was at 18. This panel discussion is focusing on the rule of law part, I guess you would say, democracy, governance, and the rule of law. And I'll pick up on the paraphrase that Professor Doyle offered a few moments before the break about law as a constraint on democratic tendencies, what that meant to Kant and what it means today, which may be very different things. As was the case with the first discussion, we have two speakers to launch the discussion for 10 minutes or so each, and then we will open the floor, and I'll try to recognize speakers along the way. Our first speaker is Pablo de Greiff, who is the Director of Research at the International Center for Transitional Justice here in New York. You see his bio in the speaker biographies. He's degrees from Yale and Northwestern. He was, before joining the TJ Center, he was a professor in the philosophy department in the State University here in Buffalo. He's published widely on a range of fields, including transitions to democracy, democratic theory, and the relationship between morality, politics, and law. He's edited 10 books, titles there, including a most recent one, Disarming the Past, Transitional Justice and Ex-Combatants. He's the recipient of several fellowships and awards, including one from NEH. He was the Rockefeller Faculty Fellow at the Center for Human Values at Princeton. And while at the TJ Center, he's provided technical advice to the UN, to the ICC, to truth commissions and other bodies in Colombia, Peru, Guatemala, Morocco, and other countries. He's working now on a World Bank project concerning 2011 World Development Report. And then following Pablo de Greiff, we will listen to Christian Vanevesser, who has served as permanent representative of Liechtenstein to the United Nations since 2002. He's also the president of the Assembly of States Parties to the Rome Statute. Between 2004 and 2009, he served as chair of the Special Working Group on the Crime of Aggression. Previously, he also served as vice president of the 61st session of the General Assembly, vice chair of an open-ended working group on Security Council reform, chair of an ad hoc committee on the scope of legal protection under the 1994 Convention on the Safety of United Nations and Associated Personnel, chair of the General Assembly's third committee, and previously, Mr. Vanevesser worked as counselor and deputy permanent representative of Liechtenstein to the UN and as a diplomat in the Office for Foreign Affairs there. He studied literature, languages, history, and philosophy at Zurich and international affairs in Geneva. Pablo, would you take the floor, please?
I want to thank everyone for the invitation and all of you for coming here. So also, I would like to make a preliminary comment about the location of this text, which I find incredibly rich, funny, frustrating, challenging, sometimes boring. I don't think that it hangs together very, very well. It's a small universe in 30 pages, and I would like to locate that within the broader Kantian project, which really tried to answer three fundamental questions. So the whole critical project was supposed to help us answer, what can we know? what ought we to do, and what may we hope for. And you can see strands of these three fundamental preoccupations of Kant throughout this short text. So I said, I think it's wonderful. I think it's funny, the comments about camels being the boats of the desert, for example. The second secret article calling for rulers to pay attention to philosophers, I find particularly appealing, given that I am a philosopher myself. It's also incredibly, incredibly serious in its efforts to address the three questions that I mentioned before, including, for example, a very serious discussion and a very complicated one, which I do not think we have been able to do much better on, about the relationship between personal individual incentives on the one hand and historical factors and historical movers on the other, and how to understand the place of individual decision-making, which we think is free decision-making on the one hand, and on the other, causally determined forces under which he, I think, correctly assumed we always operated. And all of this being done in the space of about 30 pages, while dealing with an incredibly complicated problem about the relationship between state formation, state structures, and international security. So it's, again, a contradictory text in the sense that it expresses highly ambitious universalistic aspirations, and at the same time, it embodies some of the prejudices of the age. I was very puzzled by the invitation to participate in this project, not the least because I am always worried that for short discussions about historically important texts, the text will come under criticism for failing to provide formulaic solutions to some of the problems that we face. There is a strong temptation to do that. So, of course, we could say this is a text that doesn't provide any formulas for the solution of the problems that we are dealing with, not the least, for example, because it was written without any deep familiarity with forces that became very, very significant subsequently, and those include nationalism, for example. They include unconventional warfare. They include state fragility, problems that worry us a great deal, but that were not necessarily the subject of concern for Kant. And nevertheless, despite those limitations, I would like to emphasize some contributions that the text can make to some of our present discussions. The first, of course, is a rich understanding of peace that goes beyond, as he put it, the mere cessation of hostilities. And I think that this is something that subsequent developments have shown to be a very important direction shifter in the debates about these issues. I will, of course, not have time to develop any of these things. I will just mention them as important contributions and close shortly. The second, of course, is putting at the center of our debates about international security questions about domestic legitimacy, which, of course, was a novelty at the time, and it is still something that we grapple with. The third is something that may look, and sometimes in the text itself, sounds quaint, but that nevertheless, again, we do not seem to have been able to do much better than it, namely an incredible trust in the power of law to mediate relationships, not just between citizens and the state, but also between states. So the whole project of taking peace seriously for Kant is a project that has to go through the step of taking law seriously. And the fourth point, and I hope you see that these are four related points, I think that the text makes a huge contribution in taking seriously the importance of trust-building measures and on the very useful role that law can play precisely in the stabilization of expectations. Again, both within nation states and outside. And all these points I see as axes that radiate from the crucial contribution that the text has made. And obviously not just this particular text, but the Kantian project in general has made in putting the notion of a robust regime of rights as a critical construct around which to organize one's thinking about politics, both at the domestic and at the international level. I think that these are contributions that have proven in subsequent years to have really shifted completely the way that we debate about this. And I will close with just a brief commentary about the very nice introduction that that Bill gave me, mentioning a surprising context in which I see some of the consequences of the Kantian project. Of all places, at the World Bank. So as some of you may know, the current WDR report is on conflict, security, and development. And a fundamental part of the discussion in the report has been, A, about the significance of legitimacy in discussions about violence, conflict, and development. Internal legitimacy, B, about the importance of rights, both as a catalyst of cycles of violence that endanger both internal and external security, and in the third place, about the relevance of international norms for moderating the conflictive tendencies that are now, of course, seen to be both of national and of international significance. So if even in the work of the bank, we see the echoes of a project that's got us started in thinking about the significance of norms, the significance of confidence, the contribution that law can make to stabilizing expectations, and the significance of robust right regimes, despite all the shortcomings and the frustrations that it generates, it must have gotten something right. So I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. I'll speak from here. You mentioned that I did study philosophy. Kant was one of the most unpopular philosophers at the university. He's part of that tradition of German philosophy that was, you know, almost incomprehensible. Kant is an author that is extremely difficult to read, as pretty much everybody in his generation was, and then things changed when Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and other great writers came about. But this text is a bit different. This text was a more popular read among us as students because it is actually not that difficult to understand, and it is short. And it was a great, it was really a nice experience for me to go back to it. I think my experience is similar as yours. I hadn't really looked at it in a very, very, very long time. And when I did read it, I was not dreaming to be an ambassador at the UN next time I would look at it. So it was a really nice opportunity. I think it really is a puzzling text in a way, because on the one hand it is really visionary, and this is a very radical text. On the other hand, it seems, you know, from our perspective today, I think also a bit incoherent, and it is lacking things that we would naturally expect there. So I think it is visionary in that it foreshadows some of the cornerstones of the UN Charter. I think you have sort of a nucleus of the right of self-determination in it. You have Article 2.7 of the Charter in it. And other things. On the other hand, it is not really a text that provides for any mechanisms for conflict resolution, as far as I can see. So it seems to be premised on the understanding that if everybody has the right system of government, that will in the long run lead to a perpetual peace. It does not deal with what we call today international humanitarian law, which of course is also a reflection of the different nature of warfare in the time of writing today. It does not really deal with the illegality of war either. It just says things that you should not do in carrying out an armed conflict. So in that sense, I think it seems very incomplete in a way from our perspective today. But I think the other aspects, for me anyway, in rereading, the visionary and the radical aspects do prevail and are more important. Now I'll try to address a bit the questions that you have posed in your outline. The importance of democracy and the importance of rule of law, I think, is the central question that you have posed in a way for this session. I sort of separate them in a way mentally. I don't think it's the same thing, democracy and the rule of law. And I think I'm speaking very much from my perspective as a UN ambassador. I think it is extremely important to say that the rule of law is really at the heart of a collective security system. This is what the UN is really based on. This is what the strength of the UN is in that particular area. In the area of peace and security, the strength of the UN is to say this use of force is legal, this use of force is illegal, and to take collective measures against it. So at the heart of it, at the heart of the UN, in the system of collective security, is the law. And this is why the rule of law is central. We have, you may know that we have as a delegation, together with the delegation of Mexico, a long-standing initiative in the General Assembly on the promotion of the rule of law at the national and international level. And we think it's extremely important to look at those two things in conjunction. Rule of law at the national level, good governance, I think, is something that we're talking about on a daily basis, where the UN is extremely active, where I think the UN has done very, very successful work with very different agents that are involved, from UNDP to the Office of the High Commissioner to the bank, all kinds of actors. But it's also extremely important that we look at the international dimension. So the rule of law at the international level. And that means, I think, for our purposes at the UN, in particular also in the Security Council. And that is a question that I think requires more discussion, because some people believe what the Security Council decides is the law. Other people believe what the Security Council decides has to be within the law. And that is not the same thing. That's not to say that they're mutually exclusive at all. I think they can and should be reconciled. But we have seen instances in the past where there has been a conflict between the two. And I think we need to look at this very carefully. Of course, the Security Council itself has a special responsibility in this respect, but it really falls on all of us, because the Council is, of course, doing its work on behalf of all of us, as the Charter of the United Nations says. Now, the promotion of democracy, I think it is certainly extremely important. The way I understand Kant's statement is the importance of representative government. He actually makes a point of saying a Republican government as he promotes it is not a democracy. But he is, I think his notion of a Republican constitution government is pretty close to our notion of democracy, and democracy had a less negative tone at the time. Again, I think what the UN is doing here, and much of that is not very well known, it's, I think it's part of those activities that do not get the limelight and the public attention. I think that work is extremely important, but I think it's also important that we do not impose any particular or any unique system of democracy. So as many others, I think I have always been very skeptical of notions of a community of democracies, because I do believe that the UN is exactly the place where you also have to be able to deal with those that do not have the same political system as you, and that of course is the only way of really ensuring a collective security system. And finally, perhaps, and then unsurprisingly, given the work that I'm doing currently on the ICC, I think I want to say a word on the importance of that particular aspect of the rule of law, and that is simply the fight against impunity for what are the most serious crimes under international law. And, you know, under the Rome Statute, those are genocide crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. And you probably know that we have this summer at the Kampala Conference found a definition of the crime of aggression, and that no earlier than 2017, the ICC will have the possibility to exercise jurisdiction over that crime. And that, I think, is something that we all have to digest and we have to process, and we do have 7 years to do that, but I do believe it really marks a quantum leap in the in our system of international institutions. The illegality of the use of force, other than in extremely narrowly defined circumstances, is, of course, at the core of the United Nations. That is the whole idea of the UN Charter. So what we will be able to have, if we decide so, I mean, now we have the legal texts, we will have to activate those legal texts in 2017, is, I think, for the first time really in history, the possibility of penalizing and of punishing the perpetrators. That means people that have committed the crime of aggression as part of an act of aggression, in that sense, of course, as a violation of the UN Charter. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I can't resist the temptation before we open the discussion more generally to pursue the ICC case for a moment. What, Pablo and Ambassador Van Vassar, what would Kant say about the ICC? And in what respects does it embody the principles in this first article in Perpetual Peace?
As is well known, Kant had a very, very strong view on the obligations to punish. And he considered this, I mean, obviously he's well known for thinking that this is an obligation that stands even if it imperils states. It's a moral obligation that can be justified aside from any positive consequences. Of course, not being naive, as he demonstrates in this text on perpetual peace, if you could, in addition to the independent moral justification, show that there is an institution that diminishes the costs of punishing international crimes, that strengthens the rule of law, not the least by making sure that the force of the relevant international norms is obvious for all to see, and that it does it at the same time diminishing the risks of enforcement for particular nation states. I don't think that there is any doubt that he would see this as a valuable project to pursue. So.
I think it's a bit difficult to say on the basis of the text, because there are very important aspects that have to do with this institution are in a way not addressed at all. But I would also think that based on his general approach and his general philosophy, he would look at an institution like the ICC in a very favorable light, while perhaps he would have slightly different views on the scope of jurisdiction given to the court. That's possible.
Let's open it up for discussion now. Please show your interest in speaking by turning your card up. Again, I may move up to the front of the room so I can see everyone. Mr. Tomasil Soli.
Thank you very much. I wanted to stress one point that was raised in the previous session that is relevant to this session as well. There is one of the questions in this panel about what is the proper role of the international community in promoting good governance and the rule of law, or in strengthening weak and fragile states, and how should liberal regimes be addressed by the international community. There was a reference both in the presentation by the representative of the European Union and the intervention by Ambassador Galvez to the Organization of American States. I think that we do have examples, in fact, more at the regional level than at the global level, of instruments that may equip and legitimate international action in the case of a non-democratic, unconstitutional, I would say, rupture of the democratic order, as it is named in the charter, the charter on democracy, the Inter-American Charter on Democracy. Perhaps it is worth noting that the charter had been approved on September 11, 2001, so that there was really a very strong pressure in adopting such a charter, also in the wake of what happened here and in Washington. So there is, again, perhaps an undertext linking democracy, protection of democracy, and the security agenda. Nobody would have been able to foresee that on that day the two events would have taken place at the same time. But let's look at how that instrument has been used in the cases of unconstitutional ruptures. I think that, first of all, there was a problem of definition of what this rupture is. Secondly, there is a problem of effectiveness in the mechanism to activate the charter. And thirdly, there is also an issue on who can call intervention by the OAS in the case of this unconstitutional rupture, be it the government or other entities, a parliament, or even other non-state actors. So you see that even in this area, which is probably the most advanced area, we do have a charter for the African Union, but it has not yet been ratified by sufficient number of states for it to come into force. It is more advanced on paper. Even in the case of an instrument where you do have a norm and a mechanism which is established, there is difficulty in activating it. And I think this is one first challenge. So I think Mancini made reference to the effectiveness or relationship between normative frameworks on one hand and practice on the other. And I think we should look at that linkage with a lot of attention. What does it lack when you do have a normative framework and still it can be regarded, as Ambassador Galvez said, as a very important goal? How can it be turned into something practically more effective? And I would have also a second comment, which is more about the reality of the Security Council. To what extent the Security Council, as it is now, is addressing other dimensions of the complexities of the collective security that, or the other dimensions of security that were not at the core of the establishment of the Security Council and are now prominent. And I was very struck, for example, last year by the debate on drug trafficking as a threat to security in the Security Council. That was quite an innovation, I would say. In my perspective, it is also related to the issue of democracy, because drug trafficking, and more broadly speaking, illicit the use of illicit funding can actually capture also political processes, including political parties or state institutions. And that is a threat to democracy, and at the same time also a threat to security, if we have to take the interest of the Security Council in this issue at the face value. So I would issues that are in the Security Council agenda that are already addressing elements that are not framed in the conventional security discourse.
Thank you. So two very rich comments. And in the first, your linkage metaphor between the normative and practical, I think, aligns with the relationship between international and domestic measures to bring these principles into reality. And on your second point, certainly the lessons from the example that you cite are rich. Let me ask Greg Lambert to speak, and then Mr. Toro Carnevale.
Thank you, Bill. My name is Greg Lambert. I'm the director of the Humanities Center at Syracuse University, along with Aaron Levy and Martin Rauschbauer, the Austrian Cultural Forum. We actually are the organized, we conceived of the idea or the concept of the Perpetual Peace Project, which is an instigator, I'd say, of this forum today. And it's been arranged, and it's a really wonderful event. I wanted to remind us of some of the structure, the architectural structures of Constext, and why we chose Constext. Constext is not to be understood as a master text in any way, but as a historical document that demonstrates vividly and dramatizes some of the historical gaps that we face today. And I would just like to point out in a few places, we really saw this kind of forum as the structure of the secret article itself is very, very crafty and ironic. And I think we could spend a lot of time discussing how we are enacting that secret article, the structure of the possibility of a separation of public and private spheres, where the idea of peace would only be able to exist or continue to exist in what Kant would define as a private sphere, a sphere occupied by the philosopher, separated from the public realm and from the legal realm of governments. And I think that what I've heard today in many places, and I think one of the historical things that we might consider, is the convergence or a tendency to collapse the notion of peace and security. And I think that what this text, the Kant's document, enacts is really a moment of the separation of these two concepts. A notion of a concept of peace that is assigned to philosophy, sometimes called idealistic, otherworldly, has no practical place within the realm of law and so forth, and the realm of security, which operates the notion of what peace is, and how it can be practically realized within legal frameworks and within instruments of law. But the other historical consideration I want to raise is the very notion of the forecasting of what the United Nations is as fulfilling the role of what Kant called foedus pacificum. A foedus pacificum is a league of peace. But in this sense, Kant had already foretold that everything he's talking about constitutes an impossibility to realize under the current framework of international laws. Because under the current frameworks at that time, and I think even today, all nations would have to cede the right to sovereignty in order to participate in what he called the universal concept of cosmopolitanism. In other words, the idea that there could be no, he talks even about the current compromise formation of a league of nations that could spread out all over the world and eventually include every nation, so-called, and yet would still not constitute the positive conditions of perpetual peace or of a universal cosmopolitanism in society. So I think that one of the things that that I've heard that is really interesting to talk about is how Kant's text himself builds in an enormous pessimism concerning the realistic conditions of his present moment. And the last thing I will say will concern, even in the context, if we think about this text being written by a philosopher and taking the form of a peace treaty, which of course he would know that no one would take it seriously, it's the most vivid dramatic element of the separation of the role of the so-called philosopher at that time and the statesman that he's enacting and in fact reminding. But the other thing is that he writes it in response to a very specific historical context, the Treaty of Basel, in which it was the first constitution. And that treaty contained a secret clause that reserved and, in fact, conditioned the occasion for future war, a conspiracy between Austria to set up a puppet government in Brussels and for the English to use piracy as a means of pursuing their war to bankrupt Napoleon. And so I think that the very function of the secret clause and the pressure of the appeal that Kant makes, that the philosopher would have a public place to speak about a concept of peace that could never be entertained politically, is a very powerful gesture. So I just thank you for this opportunity for this kind of discussion to take place.
Those are great comments, Greg. And let me ask a question of you, if I may, following up the distinction that you think Kant made between peace and security. I agree, that's a very useful innovation. Is it then fair to say that security is simply the absence of war?
I think that this would take a long time to develop a very close reading of this, but he begins to constantly redefine the notion of how the prohibitive instruments of law and the coercive instruments of law can create conditions of security, but they must not be understood as the positive constitutional definition of what peace is. In other words, so it's the separation of a legal and necessary legal concept of peace that is historical and no longer exists within the religious framework of eternal peace. And I think it's a separation of the church and the state within that time, the separation of the two powers. But I think that at the same time, and that the fact that the legal powers and the legal frameworks, as Kant saw, would be at the center of the modern state, as he also saw in the conflict of the faculties, that the state needs and trains lawyers in order to operate because it becomes the center part of state power. But I think that the fact that philosophy is reserved a place for a antiquated, archaic, and somewhat idealistic and quasi-religious concept of peace is to reserve a place in the future for the idea that there can be the preservation of a peace that would be lasting and that would not be produced, in a sense, either by war or by security.
Well, there should be some cards going up now. Mr. Toro Carnevale.
Thank you. And thank you for the presentation. It's very, very interesting. I just wanted to make a point, and I hope this is the right moment to do it. And it has to do, obviously, with the concept of liberalism, and we've all spoken about separation of powers. We've spoken about pluralism as being the main features of liberalism, and I think that we have left behind one of the fundamental ideas behind the concept of liberalism, which is the idea that the individual within a liberal society must be impassionate and must be acultural and asocial. It must not have primordial ties or things that keep it keep him or her from being completely open to different views. So in a sense, from the liberal point of view, this is a person who has evolved into these superior sphere where cultural or historical or social ties have been left behind. And of course, this is the concept that has been developed by Kant's hero, John Rawls, around the idea of the veil of ignorance. So if we take this to be the ideal liberal being, then we also have to take into account, if we want to create a liberal cosmopolitan community, that any unit that pertains to that liberal cosmopolitan community must also leave behind its cultural ties, its search for a continued fight for against inequality, and leave behind its history. And I find the possibility of that cosmopolitan community very difficult to establish. So I wanted to put that on the table and perhaps see what the speakers have to say on that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And obviously, I think that it would be more interesting to have the discussion at the level of possibilities and the institutions rather than texts. But let me just, for the sake of discussion, offer an alternative interpretation of what the liberal project was about, understood from a Kantian and also from a Rawlsian perspective. It was never intended to be a full theory of the good and to describe how human beings ought to live their lives to maximize their potential. It was a much less ambitious theory connected with feasible government structures that would allow individuals to make those sorts of decisions on their own. So the later interpretation that Rawls himself gave to his theory as being a political, not a metaphysical theory, I think is shorthand for the understanding that this was never meant to describe a full conception of the good life, but rather some important institutional constraints that would inevitably have to be supplemented by institutions of other sorts, formal and non-formal, operating both at the individual and at the cultural level. So this was not a whole theory of social reality, but just a small part, which enables the possibility of a search for a type of cosmopolitanism that doesn't have the perverse requirements that I think you mentioned. If the price of cosmopolitanism was the total abandonment of both individual and group affiliations, I would agree with you that that would be a very, very high price to pay, and one that, as a matter of fact, most people, it's not just that they would not be willing, but that they could not even begin to imagine how to go about paying that price. But there is equally an alternative to cosmopolitanism, not understood, again, as a supra-theory or a meta-theory of the good life in a global society, but rather a minimalist project that would allow for the creation of institutions that in turn would enable projects of a more local and national level to proceed, not just unhindered, but actually aided by a more inviting international context. And I think that this is not mere speculation, that the catalytic effect that supranational institutions have had, as a matter of fact, on nationalist local attachments, for example, within the European Union, I think serves as an example of how that sort of phenomenon can actually take place. So I am not nearly as pessimistic as you seem to be about the prospects, both of liberalism, understood modestly, and cosmopolitanism, again, understood with some sort of modesty of what its goals are about. Good. Okay.
Democracy within the UN system. I'm currently the chairman of the UN Democracy Fund, but that's not a hat that I'm wearing right now. I'm in my professor's hat. So my comment is that I think, Kristen, you're exactly right. There is a tension built into the UN system. The criteria of membership were, so to speak, the non-Kantian one of peace-loving rather than republics or any other concern for the establishment of a scheme of the rule of law at the international level. And that was a very conscious decision made at San Francisco. And when we think of who the states were that created the UN, we understand perfectly well that that would be the relevant criterion. But at the same time, the international community is instantiating democracy as part of the panoply of human rights, seen not as actual rights that were either enforceable or demandable or that were perfect, but instead were aspirations. And democracy was one of those aspirations. So I think it's interesting to look at how the UN tries to deal with that tension. And I think on the one hand, we see in peacekeeping that we almost never see an imposition of democracy by the UN on a conflict-ridden society. But nonetheless, many peacekeeping operations have part and parcel of them democratization. And that largely comes through the negotiation process. You know, imagine factions that have been shooting at each other, killing each other, can't come to an agreement on their own. When they call in the UN under those circumstances, the question is, how will they live together if you can't arrive at a peace? And the answer is that no one of them can dominate. The international community is not going to rule them other than for a short period. So in some way, you have to open up a space for legitimate contestation, which is the local operational notion of quasi-democratization, which is, of course, if you get it, the best you get into these operations. So again and again, you see elections as part of peacekeeping, not because democracy is the only good form of government. That's not the presumption, but that is a technical solution to the problem of getting into factions that will not cooperate, do not agree upon common ends, to decide how power will be shared. So I think that's one part. The second part that reflects that tension is that when we look at our democratization activities, either in the electoral division or in UNDP, they all take place with the consent and the full approval of the government. The government says, electoral division, come in and give us some capacity assistance. Or UNDP, provide us with some advice and training for our legislatures or our officials, because that's what we want. Again, non-imposition. At the UN Democracy Fund, again, we fund democratic social movements, but only at their request. That is, these requests come from the field, and we fund them around the world. So some are in established democracies that need to be deepened. Others are in countries that are not at all democratic, but that are willing to tolerate some elements of their civil society engaging in either small or big D democracy, big D being electioneering, small D accountability at the local level. The UN Democracy Fund has three projects in China, for example, with the full support and understanding of the government of China. And the key there, again, is that it comes from them, not imposed by the United Nations. And if a member state doesn't really like it, you know, one of their NGOs goes to apply for funds for voter education, let us say. If the government doesn't like it, we don't go to them to say, do you approve it or not, ex ante, but ex post, the government will, we found repeatedly, arrest the NGO and say we can't provide the funding. So there is a governmental response to UN Democracy Fund funding, which means that it's totally locally derived. And I think those are ways in which, those three ways in which the UN system is incorporating this tension, that it's an organization of peace-loving states, therefore open to any state that claims that status. And yet at the same time, the international community in the Universal Declaration and in legal instruments since then has instantiated democracy in the broad, non-restrictive sense of that term as a worthwhile goal to pursue.
Very valuable comments. Yes, Ambassador.
Thanks so much. I think I can simply say I fully agree with what you have said. And I think the activities of the UN in those areas are you know, among the most successful activities of the UN. And I think it is very clear that the UN has had tremendous success, for example, in electoral processes. I will never question that at all. You know, the only thing that I find difficult, and I was actually not talking about, you know, democracy, I was talking about notions of community of democracies, mm-hmm. and talking about, you know, we should not be talking to these people because they don't have a political system that we approve of. Mm-hmm. And I think that is not how I understand the UN. Mm-hmm. And that I don't believe that is the function of this institution. And I believe we will always have a credibility problem with these things because we will always be, in a way, very selective in saying, okay, you know, you are not a good global citizen and you are perhaps also not, but we need you sufficiently to have you at the table. So I was merely talking about that.
If I may make two observations, one of which is actually an invitation to have a debate about something that is puzzling, but not with respect to the UN, but with respect to the international community. One of the questions in the instructions that we received was about how the international community should deal with weak and non-democratic states. And this is part of the debate. And I understand the limitations that the UN has on this, but also the very positive contribution of having the UN be the sort of community of peace-loving states that Professor Dole just mentioned, and not to exclude anyone on that account. At the same time, I wonder whether the international community should not be doing more to overcome some of the Cold War-related traumas about the relationship between human rights and democracy, about the connections between the rule of law and democracy, in the work that I... And this is precisely the discussion that I would invite, and here I can unleash my Kantian Habermasian inclinations and say that from my standpoint, a defensible understanding of the rule of law is very, very closely connected with a thick and much more than purely procedural understanding of the rule of law. In other words, there is a very deep connection between effective protections of basic rights and the possibility of protecting political participation. How democracy is shaped, of course, is a question that admits of many answers, but that there is a robust connection between participatory rights on the one hand and the traditional civil and political rights, which are usually understood to be the subject of protection by a formalist understanding of the rule of law, I have no doubt. And it seems to me that at the international level, that is part of the next arena of discussion. Perhaps democracy itself has become too much of a loaded term, although again, I think that we should revise what's behind some of that trauma. The discussion is about the rule of law, because that is a subject of consensus, which I saw, for example, both from the Chinese and from the European Union and, of course, the United States in discussions at the World Bank. So everyone agrees that the rule of law is a good thing. What they mean by the rule of law, of course, differs tremendously. And this might be a good opportunity at the international level to think about what is it exactly that it, what it means. Because from the standpoint of institutions like the ICC, for instance, part of the work that I do in transitional justice suggests again and again that countries that commit themselves to a purely formalist understanding of the rule of law are precisely countries that subsequently, in Truth Commission reports,
in criminal trials, in the sort of retrospective examination of instances of systemic violence that they have undergone, they admit that a purely formal understanding of the rule of law was insufficient to stem some of those abuses. So it's not that this is an isolated example. Chile, Argentina, South Africa. I mean, you can multiply the examples, not to speak, of course, the very deep discussions in Germany, the post-war era about the sufficiency or insufficiency of formalist understandings of the rule of law. That is part of the debate.
So let me ask you to make more concrete by an example how you would apply the rule of law in weak or failed states now.
That's obviously, I wish that I had a clean, crisp solution. And actually, that's one of the things, one of the messiness of Kant's text that I like. For someone who is so well known for being a non-consequentialist and representing one side of a philosophical debate about what should be the proper relationship between principles on the one hand and the recalcitrant reality on the other. Namely, you never abandon principle. You try to get reality to conform to it. And he's a very clear exponent of this. But the point is, he does it in a non-naive sort of way, namely by being willing to admit a sort of gradual progression in the direction of a more normatively acceptable social and political reality. I think that a similar sort of a concession will have to be made with respect to a robust understanding of the rule of law in weak states. It would be easy for people like me, being an NGO in New York City, to come to these countries and say, okay, here's the full catalog of human rights, including democratic rights. Now apply them. But that is, I think, completely naive, right? So one of the interesting aspects of the empirical work that was done for the WDR is a measurement of the time it takes for even willing reformers, countries that are willing to engage in aggressive institutional reform, how long it takes them to go one step up in the bank's index of fragility, between 25 and 30 years, for highly compliant, cooperative, willing societies. Now, ignoring how difficult it is to do effective institutional reform would be a huge mistake. So some of the problems that Kant deals with in this text, he's not calling for the abolition of standing armies now. He's not calling for declaring war illegal the day after the essay was published. He's calling for people not to abandon principle, to try to come up with sensible, gradualist implementations of the norms, fully cognizant of the social and human limitations. Right, so he's not talking about a republic of angels. He's explicitly talking about structures to mediate politics in republics of devils, as a matter of fact. And this is something that we're going to have to face much more seriously in weak states. Given what we know about the difficulties of institutional transformation, where are we going to put our energies? Which choices and which sequencing choices are we going to force upon countries? Hopefully, abandoning something that we learned doesn't work in the past. The traditional sequence of we do development first, well, security in the immediate post-conflict context, development second, and then democracy and human rights third. I hope that despite all the realism that we have about the difficulties of sequencing, that lesson about very simple separations of security, development, and rights is one that has tended not to work in the past for reasons that, to a large extent, are very well explained by Kant. So, sorry, I wish that I had a short, crisp answer.
That was a very, very powerful answer and deep explanation. I can't imagine, however, that everyone around this table accepts the prescription that Professor de Graeff has offered. Yes, sir.
Mr. de Graeff just got me thinking in a particular direction now. My mic is on. Am I audible now? Okay. So this is it. So nice when we speak within a particular context of what Kant is talking about and when we talk about projected views and concepts. But the reality as I see it is that the international community, and I say this with the mind that the international community even remains to be fully defined as to what is meant by the international community. Sometimes when interest does converge, then it speaks with one voice. But usually there are blocks, various blocks of interest that work on issues. And taking it from that point, you get to realize that the quote-unquote international community can be very indulgent in what it approves and very indignant in what it disapproves. And that makes it problematic when it comes to talking about a gradualist approach or not, because in certain cases, it assumes a very abrasive tone when it moves into bloc politics. And there's a sense of immediacy concerning what has to be achieved. And I'm talking about a realistic view about what happens. And sometimes there is this quiet relapse about what is indulged, and that is not escaped. That does not escape everyone. So I thought I should just flag that, because it's not something that we can just overlook. Thanks.
Could I ask you, Mr. Afri, to offer a concrete example as well about a situation where defining the international community could have left out an important constituency?
I do this with hesitancy because I'll have to speak to it, because sometimes you have to be provocative. But that balance between being provocative and offensive always has to be carefully attained. And I hate the whole concept of the victim mindset. So I'm speaking with this consciousness that it isn't with a victim's mindset. But you see situations where, for example, when we talk about the ICC and we look at the evolution of events, I like the point that was made that Kant would have been happy with the fact that the ICC had been set up. But as to the scope of his jurisdiction, he might have raised questions. And you see a case where the African bloc came out with a position concerning the possible trial of a head of state. And yet, within the membership of the ICC, there was a division. And to be just blunt, the Western Bloc wanted action now, whilst the African group was saying no. And I saw progressives, quote unquote, countries like Ghana, etc., which would have preferred that the ICC builds its jurisdiction, feel slighted when its views were overlooked, because it is also part of the African Union. And so you cannot just speak as one country. And there were other countries which were actually ready to support the ICC, but would have preferred we're prepared to support action by the ICC, but would have preferred that a gradualist approach would have been used. So that is just a straightforward response.
Perfect.
To that.
Thank you. You want a brief response? Yes.
What do you mean by a gradualist approach? What do you mean by that?
A decision had been taken. I'm just trying to go down memory lane now. A decision had been taken, and the head of states wanted first that they have their own approach towards that. The African Union heads of states wanted the institution itself to find a way towards resolving the issue regarding the president of the Sudan. And there was this issue about the prosecutor of the ICC just going ahead to take action. And there was a little bit of hesitancy. My facts, I need to get very clear, but I know this concerning the positions of individual countries, which would have ideally supported that the ICC in taking action, but would have preferred that the views of the AU be taken on board first before any action is taken.
Say something quickly. Well, as you know, I think the Security Council created jurisdiction of the ICC in Sudan. Sudan is not a state party to the Rome Treaty. So without the action by the Security Council, there would not have been jurisdiction. Now, I've talked to people, I don't know how many days of my life about this particular file. Nobody has ever said to me, I do not believe that very serious crimes were committed in Darfur. Nobody has ever said that. And of course, you know, you cannot ask a court to take into account the views of a political organization, because then it's not an independent court. The African community is actually the most significant, numerically the most significant part of the ICC family, so to speak. There's 31 states that from Africa that are members of the ICC. What the African Union has asked is a suspension of the indictment against President Bashir for 12 months. That is an action to be taken or not taken. That is simply a decision to make for the Security Council, again, not for the ICC. The ICC is simply an independent court. It does its investigations and it has come to the conclusion that there is sufficient evidence to issue an indictment against President Bashir. And I know how difficult that is politically.
Thank you. Professor Barkan. Excuse me just a moment.
I just want to reiterate, I think, a point that Ambassador Wenwes made earlier on, and it's just food for thought, because it got me thinking again. Yeah. He said that some people believe that what the council decides is law. Others do believe that what the council decides should be within the law. They are not mutually exclusive, but sometimes it can butt heads. And I think this is one of the issues, at least depending on where you stand, where people will raise questions that if it's in the hands of the council, it may be permissible, but is it legal, and what is the framework within which they're operating? So this is one of the things that I wanted to mention. And I was not here for at the outset. But it was one of the things that I wanted to talk about that, well, Ken's view seems to have relevance in relevant time, in recent times in view. This is moving to just a different point altogether. That in terms of the evolution of global values, it is interesting to look at a continent like Africa, where 20 years ago you could not talk about intervention in state issues when they had the OAU, and now having a legal framework under the AU where the continental body is empowered to interfere on various levels up to what we'll call Chapter 7 provisions at the UN forcefully in sovereign states' issues. And I'm thinking that this is an evolution in thought. And it's gaining convergence globally. This is where things are moving towards, but just something for others to think about.
Thank you. Mr. Barkin.
Thank you. It seems that the conversation has, on the one hand, we have the aspiration, and on the other hand, we have the implementations of whether it's the rule of law or the other norms that are being discussed. And whenever the dissonance is there, we imagine a sort of a growing future proximity. But I wonder if the panel would care to speculate of the downside of the existence of aspirations that are not fulfilled and the rise of cynicism and skepticism, and actually the fact that we, and there have been several examples throughout the conversations when the norms apply to certain sections within the globe, but clearly we can't even imagine that would it apply to other things. I'm afraid some of the conversation from the first session is really very pertinent in here, specifically the comments about the security community and the notions that Europe and North America are sort of cohesive, but on the other hand, perhaps that an illustration more of their diminishing power rather than of the increasing centrality of the community of security. And I wonder whether so perhaps the panel can speculate a little bit about the downside of that growing not growing necessarily, but existing discrepancy.
If it's Pablo and Ambassador, would you comment? If not cynicism, then relevance. Are we as relevant as Kant would have us?
And Eleazar, here, again, I will unleash my Kantian tendencies in the following sense. And I hope, being respectful of the intention not to be sociologically naive, of course, denying the difficulties that are associated with the full implementation, the full and consistent, which I take is the core of, I think, your very apt reminder of the inconsistencies that have accompanied thus far the implementation of international laws and standards. It would be absurd to deny that. But if it is true that you have a spectrum of positions with respect to how to resolve the question of the relationship between norms and reality, and one of them is to relax the standards in the face of a recalcitrant reality, and the other one is to abide by the standards and try to think about what are the most effective ways of consistently applying them, even if it's a project that you never fully satisfy. I have no doubt about where I stand. And the problem about a possible cynicism that comes from, again, inconsistencies that I do not want to deny is a problem that would have to be confronted both through the unceasing calls for the consistent implementation of the norms on the part of those who can afford to exempt themselves from those, but also through an accurate accounting of the possibilities that these mechanisms always offer. In other words, from my perspective, in a modern internationalized cosmopolitan society, there is no alternative to taking very seriously formal legal procedures as basic mechanisms of conflict resolution, both at the local and at the international level. And at the same time, all of us know that formal legal mechanisms are always very, very blunt instruments, that their effectiveness relies upon the effectiveness of parallel systems of value transformation, of socialization, of cultural change, and that therefore, for example, to rely upon the ICC as a standalone institution and make it solely responsible for the internationalization and the internalization of international criminal justice and norms and standards is to place expectations on an isolated institution that no matter how good it were, it could not possibly bear on its own. So there are certain things that we understand, how they operate in association with one another at the domestic level, that it's easy for us to forget we need to do at the international level. No one, for example, thinks in domestic jurisdictions that you can eliminate a problem like racism and prejudice through the application of criminal justice measures alone. This is actually a generations-long project that requires not just criminal responses. This is, of course, not an argument against the criminalization of hate-related crimes, but it's an argument about the limitation of the legal instrument for the resolution of problems of that magnitude. Well, similarly, at the international level, we have to understand that the even weaker, more disconnected, much more fragmented institutions that we do have are going to be insufficient to resolve some of the problems that we expect them to resolve without the active and very, very aggressive participation on the part of different mechanisms and instances. So that's where I would stop.
Thank you. Ambassador.
Well, I'll give a very short answer. I do believe that there is a risk, because we have such a big gap in a way between the standards and the application of the standards. And I think that can lead to disenchantment and to cynicism. And I think that is the challenge. It's very tempting for us to continue engaging in standard setting exercises because these are difficult exercises, but we can get somewhere. But if we do not get better at applying what we said we would do, then we will have a very serious problem, and I think it will be a credibility problem for the UN in particular.
Mr. Palmasino, I think you get the last comment before we wrap up and have lunch. Huh?
It will be very quick. I just wanted to ask the speakers on a comment that pertains the second secret clause of Kant's philosophical sketch. And that is, it is quite bizarre that a philosophical sketch like this one would publish an idea that you have to pursue secrecy in order to achieve public, agreement on the notion of peace. Would you consider, for instance, that this text is in large part a polemical text? It's a polemical text that tries to undo and reorganize the monopoly on rule of law that is held by the jurist and reintroduce through the secret clause the possibility of having a second voice, that of the philosopher. And the second, which is a corollary to this point, is the fact that what Kant calls for, the republic and the cosmopolitanism, we tend to see from the juridical and discursive perspective as being a public and a cosmopolitan citizenship, with dismissing completely the res of the public in the Republic, that is, the things, the immaterial physical elements that are to be governed, and from the cosmopolitan, the clash about what is a cosmos, the different polemics about who is entitled to a different view on possibilities of, agreeing on the cosmos. And this is just a little... thing that I wanted to put in the discussion at the end of this session, that is, probably this text shows us also that by limiting ourselves to discussing notions of peace only through possibilities of agreeing or sharing values or sharing interests, rather than incorporating the polemics, the disagreement, the strong, misunderstandings that lie at the basis of our cohabitation, we are probably missing out on a large part of this text. And as a second point, I would also like to ask the panel, whether they could articulate a position where, let's say, non-human rights are operative. That is, rights that don't pertain mainly to human beings, but to non-human beings. What would the right of the river Indus be? What would the right of the Arctic? So how can we understand, let's say, problem of democracy, governance, and rule of law without inhabitation? For instance, the map that underlies our program today shows us a view of the Arctic, an area that is highly inhabited only through technical means. Are we going to implement there our own rules, our own governance systems, or how are we interpreting the materiality of that space? Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to respond briefly, please? Remembering that you are now the only speakers between this panel and lunch.
This makes me a very popular person.
Yeah,
sure. You know, the rights I know are human rights. And I think if we were to do a better job in implementing those, we would be addressing many of the issues that you have mentioned. I think it really goes to my point of, you know, of implementation and of application of standards. We had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. It's considered customary international law today. It's binding on every single state. If we had implementation simply of that instrument, it would be a completely different planet. And we have, after that, you know, treaty by treaty by treaty, we have created new rights, more specific rights and rights for different individuals and so on. And they're all very good. But we really have to find a way of implementing what we have.
I agree with this completely. Most of the work that I do has to do with systemic and massive human rights abuses. The record of implementation, even with respect to those, is quite poor. The mechanisms that we have are weak, and the commitment to implement them even weaker. So before broadening the agenda of rights very ambitiously, I would like to see a better record of implementation. Although I have to say that in the general scheme of things, in a sort of dialectical way, I am delighted that there are people who are always reminding us of the point that any given selection of a list of rights bearers is going to be shown to be insufficient down the line as time goes by. But for the time being, really, I think that we have a lifetime's worth of work to do on better implementation of the very, very unambitious, but nevertheless significant agenda that we have already set for ourselves. This is for us.
Good. Please join me in thanking the panelists.